Okay, I have to tell you what just happened here. I just opened my notes up and I had the wrong notes. And my heart hasn't settled down yet. And so I ran up and asked Sonny if he could be prepared to sing an extra song. When you have everything, I don't know how anybody else is, but Sunday morning's kind of a special time for me, beginning early, before daylight, and to get a couple of different lessons in my mind when you have a one-track mind, that's quite a task anyway, and then when you have something with 1 minute left, you think, okay, I'm completely messed up here. So, how many of you up on your daily Bible reading? Let me see. Wait, raise your hand up high. I can't hardly tell. Wow. It's time to catch up, folks. We had about 150 folks who agreed to read it this year, so let's make sure. It's getting close to the end of the year, so if you haven't caught up and you're in that process, I want to really encourage you to catch up. How many of you brought your Bibles this morning? Let's see. Hold them up. Hold them up. Hold them up. Good. Pew Bibles don't count. Well, everybody holds up these iPhones, you know. That's your Bible. Huh? I can't argue with it, can I? All right. If you would, be turning to Matthew chapter 13. In Matthew's presentation of Jesus as a king, he presents his credentials. He starts out very logically, and he presents who he is and what he says, and presents his credentials, his right to make the claims to be the Son of God, the Messiah that he is claiming. And then he pauses and gives some illustrations and examples of how people receive him. And one of the things that we see is we see that Jesus is being received and consequently will be received with a mixture of belief and unbelief. In some people, there is this willingness to accept the obvious of the miracles and what they mean. And yet to others, it doesn't matter how much evidence is presented, they're not going to believe. And he will illustrate a little bit earlier in chapter 8 about how there are some that are just perpetual critics. And that's all that they do. And there are people like each one of these groups of people today, that there are some people that all they do is criticize. You've allowed yourself to fall into a rut of whenever there is something presented, it almost doesn't matter what it is. You just start picking it apart. You just start criticizing it. And that substitutes for you doing anything about it. Criticism is a really interesting thing because we feel like there's something within our human psyche that if we feel like we can find fault with something, then we totally can dismiss the whole thing. And we don't have to really find fault that's legitimate. We can find any kind of fault, and we can find fault with a message, or we can find fault with a messenger. And either one of those will suffice to allow us to just dismiss it out of hand. And that's exactly what many were doing with Jesus' message and his miracles. And there are people like that today, that it doesn't matter how much. Jesus got to a point where they came to him and said, we would see a sign, and he said, no, you've had enough signs. There won't be any more signs given to you except the sign of the prophet Jonah, which, of course, was the resurrection. And multiplying miracles and multiplying signs is not going to change a heart that is bent on unbelief. That's what I've named this lesson, and it's a two-part lesson. We had the first part last time that We know, and Jesus tells us, and we hear Jesus tell us about the power of belief, that if you have belief like a grain of a mustard seed, then you can say to this mountain, go remove yourself and go jump in the ocean, and it'll do it. And he said, whatever you ask in my Father's name, you'll receive. And many, many different ways he illustrates the power of faith. And so whether or not we've applied that to our life, we intellectually understand that. We get it. That belief enlists God's power in our lives. But in a very similar way, unbelief is an extremely powerful thing also. And it has characteristics about it that are just as definite as the characteristics of belief. And last time we talked about how it blurs the obvious. It's so powerful that in our text of Matthew chapter 13, they ask the question, where did this man get this wisdom and these miraculous powers? Well, other people who were not a part of the inside, they knew. They had put two and two together, hadn't they? They had watched Jesus, and they had seen the miracles that he had done, and they had drawn the proper conclusion. The Sanhedrin Pharisee, Nicodemus, had come to Jesus, and he had said, Rabbi, we know that you're a teacher come from God, for no man could do the signs that you do unless God was with him. He could see it. It was obvious to him. And he's one of the ruling class. He's a Pharisee, as a matter of fact. And Jesus had talked to them. He had reasoned whenever they came, and those who were hung up in unbelief and under the power of unbelief, and had said, well, he gets his power from Beelzebub. Jesus had said, that can't be true. It's obvious it can't be true, because if a house is divided against itself, it's not going to stand. So all you have to do is just sit back and watch it destroy itself. And so that can't be true. It can't be true that my power comes from Satan, because I'm fighting against Satan and what Satan is doing. And so they could get it if they wanted to get it. But one of the characteristics of unbelief is that when we're faced with truth, unbelief blurs the obvious. Because if we admit that it's truth, and now we really get down to why it blurs the obvious and why we want it to, if we admit that it's the truth, we have to change our lives, and we don't want to change our lives. We like what we're involved in. So the real problem, as always, is the love of sin. And whenever you encounter someone today that just can't get it, they just don't understand it, they just don't seem to be able to put it together and come to faith and understand that Jesus Christ is who he claims he is, quite often, the reason is because there's sin involved. And we don't want to change. We like the life that we're living. It also, secondly, builds up the irrelevant. Things that are peripheral. Things that are really not a part of the heart of this matter. It reaches out and gets little insignificant things and tries to make them significant. Sounds a lot like politics, doesn't it? And really, those same principles work in life. It doesn't matter if it's politics. It doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't matter if it's what you deciding you're going to school or not going to school. Well, a lot depends on whether you want to go or whether you don't want to go. Your arguments do, don't they? And it doesn't. Everything in life is this way. It builds up the irrelevant. Verse 55 and 56, they say, isn't this a carpenter's son? Now, think about. They see these miracles that he's performing, and they say, and they hear what he's saying subsequently, and they say, isn't this the carpenter's son? And isn't his mother's name Mary? And don't we know his brothers and his sisters? We grew up with this boy. We went to school with him. We remember when. One of the interesting things about being a preacher is when you go back and you meet old classmates, they all want to talk about one thing. The things that you did together that you shouldn't have done. For some reason, it just makes them feel better. And they want to talk about those things. And, you know, I'm at a point in my life where I've tried to forget those things, put those things behind me. Well, they want to remind me, you know. And so it's some of that same thing. When an unbeliever is faced with the truth, he will attach himself to something that is totally irrelevant to, in order to divert attention away from or try to disprove the truth, as if criticizing, for instance, criticizing the messenger would disprove the truth. It doesn't. It doesn't. Truth doesn't always have to come in the door that you're looking at. Sometimes truth may even come in from someone that you despise. You may learn some truth from your most severe critic. And it takes a real man, it takes a real woman to be able to accept truth that comes in the form of harsh criticism, doesn't it? That's really, really hard to take in our lives and admit that there's any truth in what someone may say. Perhaps you've had the opportunity to hear some comments from someone who has an agenda that they don't want to attend church anymore. They say, well, the people are just not very friendly to me. Or I don't like the preacher, as legitimate as that may be. Or so-and-so goes to that church, and I know what kind of person they are, and if that's the kind of people they have down there, then I don't want anything to do with that. And they use hypocrites. Are there hypocrites in the church? Yeah. Where else would you expect to find them? That's where they are. Right? They wouldn't be hypocrites if they weren't. Invariably, unbelief diverts people from the main issue, and it centers on some side matter because we're trying to justify ourselves. And when unbelief is confronted with truth, often when people cannot refute the truth in any other way, then you resort to personal attack. And that's exactly what they've done here. They look at what Jesus has done, and even the Pharisees themselves will say, we can't deny that he has done a notable miracle. And if I can't deny that, then, and I don't want to accept the truth, then what's my next step? You start criticizing the messenger, right? You start finding fault. You start bringing in something from the side. Something that's really not relevant to the issue, and you try to make a big issue out of it to divert. So when unbelief is confronted with truth, then it looks for something else to attack. Whenever belief is confronted with the truth, you know what it says? Give me more. Give me more. It's not hard to see, is it, folks? It's not hard to see when you're discussing the Bible with someone whether or not that person is hungering and thirsting after righteousness and they're trying to come to belief or whether they're determined not to come to belief. It's not hard. And it's still that way. And unbelief is extremely powerful. And it has certain characteristics. The people of Nazareth were unbelievers, this group that's represented here. Isn't this the carpenter's son? Now, that's a put down. Right? He came from the other side of the tracks. We know where he came from. We remember that boy and his brothers. We remember their family. You know, they're not even in the upper class of the folks around here. What did his family have to do with what they had seen or heard? Nothing. Did it? His commonness, his background, in reality, should have lent credibility to what he was doing. If he did come from that kind of background, where in the world did he get this kind of power and this kind of wisdom? Wow. This has to be something from God. Wouldn't that be the logical conclusion rather than going the other way? But unbelief builds up the irrelevant. It also is blind to the truth in verse 57. He says, and they took offense at him. And the word is scandalon. They were deeply offended. They were scandalized by him. Now, I find that really interesting because it just says just prior to that, whenever Jesus first started talking, it said they were amazed. They were amazed at him. And then as they began to think about it and look at him and listen to what he had to say, they didn't like what he had to say. And so they had to figure out some way to block this truth. They stumbled over the cornerstone, didn't they? They were offended by his background, his family. They were offended by his disciples and the men that he had chosen to follow him. But most of all, they were offended by what he taught. He unmasked their hypocrisy, and he told them the true conditions for entrance into the kingdom of God, and that offended them because they were the ones to set the condition. They were the ones that had the reins. They were the ones that the people looked up to and came to whenever they needed anything. And now everybody's gone out after this Jesus, and he's taken away their popularity, and they're jealous. True belief is impossible until a person is willing to abandon sin. That's the real key to this whole thing. True belief is impossible until a person is willing to abandon sin. In verse 57, they fulfilled the proverb, only in his own hometown and with his own family is a prophet without honor. Don't you find that true? I mean, you go back home, and it's just really hard for folks to take you seriously. And you may have gone out, and you may have accomplished some things in the world. You may have, let's just say, received an education, and you go back. I go back to, and I would say my hometown, but I don't want to offend anybody from there in case it wasn't, and you know, you don't fit in anymore. And the guys that you grew up with and the girls that you grew up with, you don't have anything in common anymore. And they feel it strongly. And they're offended by that. And so consequently, they want to bring you down. And in his own country and in his own house, John chapter 7, verse 5 says, neither did his own brethren believe in him. His own brothers didn't believe in him. And then what the worst tragedy of all, of the power of unbelief, is unbelief blocks the working of God's power in your life. Verse 58, and he did not do many miracles there because of their lack of faith. That's the most tragic thing of all. Look what they had access to. And they would look at Capernaum and all the miracles that he had done there. And they would say, why don't you do some of those miracles here? We've heard that you gave sight to the blind. We've heard that you healed a little girl who was on death's door. We heard that you did this and you did this. Why don't you do some of those things here if you're such a hot shot? Some miracles were performed in the face of and because of an individual's faith. You remember the Syrophoenician woman who came to Jesus? And she just kept begging him. And he said, you don't give food to the dogs. You don't give the children's food to the dogs. She said, I know, that's right, but even the dogs get the scraps that fall from the table. And Jesus healed her because of that faith. But not all of his miracles were performed because of a person's faith. Whenever he raised the dead, Lazarus, he was going to do that regardless of who did or didn't believe standing around. Whenever he cast demons out of demoniacs, he didn't do that because these demoniacs believed. And so there are some miracles that were performed in the face of faith and because of faith, and there were others that he performed whether there was faith present or not. And so that's really not the issue here. While faith was not necessary for miracles to be performed, he sized up the situation and he said, miracles are not going to help in this situation because these people are determined not to believe. And he did not do very many miracles there because their unbelief was so powerful and so strong, and they were so determined not to believe. Now, you stop and translate that to the poor, suffering people in that area. And what a tragedy it was that his power was not brought to bear. And there were people who were suffering in their bodies that would not receive healing because of the unbelief of these leaders of the people here. What a tragedy. As you go to chapter 8, verse 6, in Capernaum, he drove out all the spirits with the word and healed all their sick. Well, Capernaum was a lot better off. Their hospitals were empty there. In chapter 9, verse 35, Jesus went through all the towns and villages, teaching and preaching and healing every kind of sickness and disease. But when he came home, he didn't do that. And there were more sick people in and around his hometown than there were even in the regions of Gentiles around. Unbelief is powerful. It blurs the obvious, it builds up the irrelevant, it blinds men to truth, and it blocks the working of God's power. In John chapter 9, there's a really, I think, pertinent illustration here. Jesus, it says, as he was going on his way, he saw a blind man who had been blind from birth. He never had seen in his life. And the disciples said, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" And he said, "Neither one of them." That's not the point here. This man was born blind so that the work of God might be displayed in his life. He was born blind for this moment that's about to happen right here. Now, you got to let that sink in, and whether or not you can handle that or not. This man was born blind. There were parents that had this child that were born blind so that one day when he grew up and Jesus came along, he could give him sight. Wow. That's pretty interesting, isn't it? And so he continues on, and this story that's told here is laid out in six different scenes. And one day we'll go through them in detail, but Jesus explains, first of all, to his disciples what this is about. And then the blind man, after he receives his sight, goes and he explains to his neighbors what has happened. This guy called Jesus came along, and he made some mud, and he put it on my eyes, and that's all I know. Now I can see. I went and washed, and now I can see. And so the neighbors took him to the Pharisees, and the Pharisees began to grill him about this. When they heard that Jesus had been involved in this miracle, then they set about to disprove this miracle. But they couldn't disprove it. There were too many people who knew about this man. They knew he had been blind his whole life, and now it was obvious he could see, and they couldn't deny either one of those facts. And so they began to attack Jesus. They said, "Who is this guy?" He said, "I don't know who he is. All I know is he came along and he did, this is what he did." So they called his parents in. They've got to find some way to discredit Jesus. And they said, "You know, tell us, is this your son? And did this miracle occur?" And they knew what the consequences were of saying that Jesus had performed this miracle, even though everybody knew it. It was politically incorrect for them to admit that Jesus had performed this miracle. And so they weren't even going to say the obvious. And so they ended up, after being grilled a little bit, and they said, "Hey, he's old enough, he's of age, you ask him, he can speak for himself." Because they knew that they'd be ostracized from the community, cast out from the temple, if they admitted that Jesus had done this miracle. Isn't that an incredible thing? How powerful sin is, that it intimidates parents who love their children. They've lived with a child that was born blind their whole life, and they've dealt with that their whole life, and now that he's a man and he can see, they can't even rejoice enough to admit what's happened. How powerful sin is. The power of unbelief is incredible, what it does to us, and it blinds us to truth. And it terrifies us. And then whenever they failed, they brought the blind man back in and they started drilling him again. They said, "Listen, give credit to God. We know that this guy is a sinner." And he said, "Hey, I don't know about any of that. All I know is I was blind and now I can see." And they kept drilling him. And he said, "Hey, do you want to be his disciple also? I like this guy, don't you?" And they became really, really angry. And they said, "You were born in sin from your birth. Get out of here. We don't ever want to see you again." And so Jesus went and found him. You remember? Scene number 6. Jesus found him. And he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" And he said, "I would if you'd tell me who he is." And he said, "That's me." And then the Bible says, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. Now, if you go back to verse 1, He told his disciples, this man was born blind so that God could be glorified. What glorifies God? When a person who's not a believer becomes a believer, God is glorified. And out of all of those folks involved, there was one man who was not under the power of unbelief. Unbelief is powerful. It's powerful. It can control whole groups of people. It can control people who are really, really intelligent people. Unbelief can cause us to be blind to things that are really obvious. Unbelief is tragic. And there's one thing that that story points out, and I'll leave you with this lesson, with this thought. There is something far more tragic than being physically blind. As tragic as that is, being spiritually blind and not being able to perceive truth and act on truth when it presents itself to you is far, far more tragic than being blind. The power of unbelief. Don't allow things in your life. Don't allow the fact that sometimes truth comes in through a door that we don't like or that we're not expecting to keep you from acknowledging truth. Truth is truth. It'll stand on its own, folks. And God has presented us with His Word, truth. And if there's something that you need to do in your life to respond to that truth, don't let unbelief be so powerful in your life that it keeps you quiet or that it keeps you in your seat. If you need to come, won't you come while we stand and sing?
Have you been to Jesus for the cleansing power? Are you washed in the blood of the Lamb?